You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
In the mid-1980s, few people thought it would be necessary to defend Americans against acts of terrorism, but after three suicide bombings in Beirut, including one that killed 241 Marines, the State Department realized the possibility of future terrorist threats was quite real. Fred Burton was one of three counterterrorism experts assigned to the murky world of hijackers, hostages, and double agents. He's chronicled his experiences in a memoir called Ghost, Confessions of a Counterterrorism Agent. It's published by Random House, and I'm very pleased that it brings Fred Burton to the show today. Hello.
Hello. Thank you for having me on.
You started your counterterrorism career with the Diplomatic Security Service in 1986. I don't remember ever hearing of the DSS before. Is it really that secretive?
This is one of the reasons why I wanted to also do Ghost, Leonard, was to chronicle and highlight the extraordinary efforts of this organization that was pretty much formed after the Beirut embassy bombings in 83 and 84. And at that time, there was the Admiral Bobby Inman Commission, and I'm honored that he wrote a testimonial for my book put together that the State Department really needed to beef up their security abroad because we had to prevent other embassies from lying in rubble. So I was one of the first Inman hires, and right out of training, I was assigned as a brand new agent to this new counterterrorism division. And in essence, I walked into a room about the size of this, and I was one of three.
People can't see it, but it's a medium-sized room.
Right. I was one of three original U.S. counterterrorism agents, and in essence, we were global detectives. We were responding out to investigate acts of terror. We were looking at the hostage takings in Lebanon, plane crashes. And there's also this third realm of threats out there, which most people don't see. And this are the constant source reports that are in that Hezbollah is planning attack here. The Abu Nidal organization is planning this here. And we were the first ones to try to look at actual threats and try to neutralize them before they materialized into actual attacks.
But aren't there dangers in going public with all this information? I would think that you, of all people, would be concerned that you might be giving valuable information to the enemy.
I think the enemy knows us much better than we like to believe. You can only look at some of our disasters and see that. If you look at the success from a historical perspective, going back to Beirut 1 and 2, which is what I chronicle, the first bombing and the second bombing, and then the follow-on kinds of attacks.
Well, there was the Achille Lauro incident. There were increase in car bombings, hijackings, all in the 1980s. Was this an increase, actually, in activities, or was it just that we were becoming more aware of this sort of thing?
There has always been, if you go back preceding the Beirut embassy bombing, there was an organization called Black September, which everybody remembers of the Munich massacre fame. And you really need to study Black September to understand how Hezbollah operates, to understand how Al-Qaeda operates today. But there was very little publicity on some of these attacks. I mean, I can vividly recall on some of the cases I work, like Libyan-backed assassination plots, where you're lucky to get a two-line piece in the New York Times or the Washington Post that this diplomat was shot abroad or this diplomat was killed. Today, with the internet, obviously that would be instantaneous, and with the radio today. But during the time that I first started, there were a lot of diplomats being attacked around the globe. And it was our job to look at these attacks and put together some lessons learned to keep others from taking place as well.
Was the Diplomatic Security Service where you wanted to be? Didn't it require pretty substantial lifestyle changes?
It really did for me. I mean, as I chronicle in Ghost, I go from being a police officer outside of Washington, D.C., into a special agent position with the Diplomatic Security Service.
You can't even tell your wife what you're doing half the time.
Exactly. And for the most part, it involved in some of the more clandestine type of operations that we were involved in, or pending hostage releases. For example, we were engaged, and I was one of the individuals that would do the debriefing of the actual hostage and whatever, whenever they were released from Beirut. So in essence, it became very secretive very quickly, and you would not tell your family what you were doing, but you would always have a bag packed.
That debriefing occurred in a rather dramatic fashion when David Jacobson was released by Hezbollah. You spoke to him in Wiesbaden. What could you learn from him?
It was important for us to talk to these hostages as quickly as we possibly can. Of course, our search was always for William Buckley, the former CIA station chief in Beirut, that we were trying to get confirmation as to whether or not he was alive or dead. And in this kind of business, you're always dealing with intelligence gaps. If you picture like a puzzle, you always have got pieces missing, and you're trying to piece it together as best you can. So in talking to these hostages that were released, we would always try to get there very, very quickly and try to learn their identity of where they were being held and their location so we could try a rescue attempt.
Well, in the case of David Jacobson, that was the beginning of the Iran-Contra scandal, wasn't it?
It certainly was. Now, I had absolutely no knowledge of that taking place behind the scenes. About my second trip across the North Atlantic from Andrews Air Force Base in a special air mission, did it dawn on me that, well, we're getting deployed before the hostage is coming out, so somebody must know what's going on. But I was too far down the totem pole, or I didn't have a need to know. So that was all being handled by others in a much higher pay grade than me.
So when did you discover that the United States was trading arms for hostages and funneling the cash to Nicaragua's Contras?
I learned when we were on one of our hostage debriefings in Wiesbaden that I think a press report leaked the fact that...
You had to learn it from reading in the press?
Yes, yes. Now, remember, in the U.S. government, you're always dealing with siloed compartments. And my job was just solely to debrief the hostage, learn what we can, and try to put together the facts that the policymakers could read.
What did Jacobson tell you about Buckley? Did he know anything?
Yes, he did. He told us that Buckley had died, which came as a shock. I can vividly recall this, Leonard. We were sitting in a hospital room, and David Jacobson, who was a wonderful witness and across the spectrum from everything that he saw, from hostage guard description to locations that he was being held, and he told us that Bill Buckley had been very ill, they had begged the guards to bring in a doctor, and they never did. And Buckley got delirious and, in essence, was coughing a lot, and then all of a sudden he stopped. And the other hostages who were chained to radiators, literally, knew something had happened. And he recalled that they could hear the hostage guards taking the body out of the bed and flopping it down on the floor, then dragging it down the stairs. And he hit the table repeatedly with the sound of his head hitting the steps. And I can remember us sitting in the room just riveted by that conversation, and we knew at that point that Buckley was dead.
Did you ever meet Oliver North as part of this investigation?
No, I did not. I never met Colonel North, no, sir.
My guest is Fred Burton, who's written a book called Ghost, Confessions of a Counterterrorism Agent. It is published by Random House. And the life you describe in this book, where special agents are called spooks, the bad guys live in what you refer to as the dark world. Well, it sounds a lot like a James Bond movie. How much of it is like that?
What I try to do, Leonard, with Ghost is chronicle the day-to-day workings. I think most people have a perception of what they see either on 24 or in a James Bond 007 movie that we were walking around with all this high-tech gadgetry and so forth. In many ways, we weren't.
Well, this is before cell phones in some cases. In 1985, you didn't have a cell phone.
We didn't even have computers. So in essence, I first started chronicling names of individuals in intelligence reports on 3x5 index cards. So I would have Hezbollah in one side of my desk. I would have Abu Nidal. And I started to draw correlations between the names and the personalities and trying to collect biodata on them.
When do you think that the technology developments, well, you left in 1998 and things had changed a lot between 1985 and 1998. Did the changes in technology make the job easier or just complicated in other ways?
The changes from a counterterrorism perspective with the enhancements with technology certainly has made us all a lot safer, meaning certain kinds of electronic tracking devices, surveillance equipment today is a lot better than it ever was. And what has really helped has been an increase in resources. But it's a double-edged sword. With the increase of resources comes a lot of other issues as well. I mean, in my conversations today, the Diplomatic Security Service is still in many ways understaffed. Although they have agents in every embassy and consulate around the world today, they really need more agents to get the job done and to do it well.
Aren't there some advances that worked against you?
Yes, in some ways what we found in trying to stay one step ahead of the various terrorist organizations were that they were at times practicing a brilliance and simplicity kind of model, meaning their ability to surveil targets prior to attacks really dawned on me, which I put in my book as well, that we were not looking for the right things. We really had to be out there aggressively looking for those individuals conducting those surveillances.
After 9/11, it became apparent that the various intelligence agencies weren't really talking to each other. Was that a problem with the DSS as well?
The bureaucratic infighting is a constant problem, meaning it still exists today. There are things that work a little bit better. For example, the Joint Terrorism Task Forces today around the country do work very well, or like we used to say, they do play well in the sandbox together. But you still have competition over sources. Who's going to have and run that asset? Is it going to be the FBI or the CIA? You have other tremendous successes. For example, the Rewards for Justice program, the $20 million for bin Laden. That is a very successful program.
Well, but you have a list of the most wanted people in the world, and Osama bin Laden is number 6. He used to be number 7 until a recent development. Why is he so low on the list?
Well, bear in mind that that's my list. That's not a U.S. government top 10 terrorist list by any stretch of the imagination. My list was my personal list that I put together over time.
You didn't consider him the number one target?
I didn't. Bear in mind, when I got in this business was long before bin Laden came around. So number one on my list was Emad Mognia, who was also known as the Fox. And the Israelis just assassinated him on February the 12th in Damascus, Syria, in a brilliant counterterrorism operation. And bin Laden came along many years later. And in many ways, Leonard, bin Laden today is irrelevant. He is contained to a very small quadrant in the northwest frontier province of Pakistan. He's been relegated to producing third-rate audio tapes that take forever to get posted on jihadist sites. He no longer has the command and control capability that he once did in Afghanistan. So in many ways, he is a non-factor.
Where is he on the U.S. government's list?
He's high on the U.S. government wanted list simply because of his past exploits. But he's at the same rank level that Dr. al-Zawahiri would be, the number 2 with al-Qaeda. And if you may have noticed this week that the Diplomatic Security Service announced a large reward offer for an American by the name of Adam Gadan, Azam the American, as he's called. And this is a kid from California that went over and got associated with al-Qaeda, and now he's being used as a propaganda tool by al-Qaeda.
My guest is Fred Burton, who's former deputy chief of the Diplomatic Security Service, the Department of State's Counterterrorism Division. He's written a book called Confessions of a Counterterrorism Agent. It is published by Random House, and we will continue our conversation after this. My guest is Fred Burton. He's written a book called Ghost, Confessions of a Counterterrorism Agent. It is published by Random House. You played a key role in the capture of Ramzi Youssef, the first World Trade Center bomber. How did you track him down?
We had an informant that came to our attention through the Rewards for Justice program that basically wanted to hand over Youssef to the Americans. And the heroic efforts by a couple of our DSS agents in Islamabad, Pakistan, basically Bill Miller and Jeff Reiner, did the bulk of the work. My role was more of a coordination role back in Washington to make sure we could pull it off. They were the ones that went in and debriefed our informant after he came to our attention and were successful in capturing Youssef at a hotel in Islamabad, and then we got him out of the country within 24 hours.
Well, as you said, your department initiated this Rewards for Justice program. How much of a bounty do you put on the heads of people like Ramzi Youssef?
It depended on the situation, meaning before the World Trade Center bombing the first time, we always looked at the bombing of Pan Am 103 over Lockerbie, Scotland, as the benchmark to offer a $2 million reward. And then, lo and behold, we had the 1993 bombing of the World Trade Center the first go-around, and we decided that if we could capture Ramzi Youssef, we would offer the full amount for that as well. And so, in essence, we had, it's no different than any other criminal enterprise. We just paid a snitch to rat him off and went and got Youssef.
And is that all the information you got from the snitch?
No, the snitch was also a very interesting person. He was able to tell us that Youssef was also planning to kill American diplomats in Islamabad, Pakistan, and give us some interesting insights as to how Youssef was able to move around in multiple identities. So it was a treasure trove of intelligence information for us when we captured Youssef.
Are you able to turn people like that into double agents?
Yes, you usually can utilize an old acronym called MICE, money, ideology, compromise, or ego. You can usually find a button to push in order to develop an asset. To be quite frank, most of these come to you for monetary purposes, meaning you pay me $250,000, I will tell you where this individual is, or I'll tell you about this plot.
Well, how can you trust these guys?
You take extensive efforts to vet that type of information, and we spend a great deal of time every day doing that. Of course, 9 out of 10 types of individuals that you get aren't worth a grain of salt, but you're always looking for that diamond in the rough, and you use a host of different means through vetting their story.
Well, even if they give you good information, there's always the possibility that they're working both sides against the middle.
Absolutely. You always take that into account, that it could be disinformation, or it could be a probe from a hostile foreign intelligence agency, or it could be Al-Qaeda themselves trying to send you down a rabbit hole where there is no information.
What happened to the snitch after he gave you the information about Ramzi Youssef?
We made the snitch a very wealthy man and were able to relocate the snitch and his family out of Pakistan and bring him to the United States and place him in the Federal Witness Protection Program.
You mentioned earlier the crash of Pan Am Flight 103 over Lockerbie. Do we know what really happened in that case? Doesn't Muammar Gaddafi keep on changing his story?
If you look, there's no doubt about that being a Libyan-backed intelligence operation. In essence, the Libyans utilized their diplomatic capabilities and their intelligence service to bring down that flight. And that's the problem when you're looking at state sponsors of terror. They can use their embassies to move diplomatic pouches, to secrete weapons, to move explosives, to manufacture identity documents. For example, any state sponsor of terror can make any person, whoever they want to be, any name. And it makes extraordinarily difficult time for those in the business to track and monitor people.
So, now that Muammar Gaddafi is a friend of the West, does that affect whether we go after this story, try to really find out what happened?
I think what you'll see is this story has very quickly disappeared. What I try to bring out in Ghost is that not only were there tremendous number of innocent people killed on that flight, there were also agents from the Diplomatic Security Service from my own organization that were coming home for Christmas that were killed. So it was one that seared into my mind.
Many listeners have been calling in wondering about other forms of gaining information, some that have been in the news, like the use of torture, the use of wiretaps, sometimes unwarranted wiretaps. Is that something that was done in the pursuit of these cases?
No, not on my watch. Torture is a tactic that I don't think anybody that's a professional intelligence officer would actually condone.
So then why do people continue to do it? I know the FBI believes that the best way to get information from somebody is to become a friend. And then when they're comfortable with you, then they'll tell you stuff. Torture, they'll just tell you whatever you want to hear. And yet we continue to do it, and we have we have people in government saying that they don't know whether waterboarding can be defined as torture or not.
I don't think that tactic is a sound practice personally, meaning throughout my career in the counterterrorism arena, you would get statements from terrorist suspects that were held in foreign jails primarily, that you knew that, those statements had come under duress. And it's true that anybody will tell you anything to stop the pain. And you could vividly see that in some of the suspects that you would talk to, that they've been beaten up or they've been tortured in some means. And in essence, I would always look at those kinds of statements with a jaded eye, knowing that that person was probably just giving you whatever first thing that came to their mind or just agreeing to whatever they participated with just to stop the pain. So personally, I think that you will find that anybody in this business really doesn't think that it works.
My guest is Fred Burton, who's written a book called Ghost, Confessions of a Counterterrorism Agent. It is published by Random House. Many people in the business will tell you that we only know about the failures, so the successes tend to be kept secret.
That's true. And when the failures happen, you have planes flying into buildings or you have embassies lying in rubble. There are a tremendous number of successes that take place. And for example, one case we used on the Rewards for Justice program, we had an individual that was associated with the Abu Nidal organization that came forward and said that he had information about a plot to shoot up an American ticket counter in Bangkok, Thailand. And we were able to thwart that plot before the terrorists were able to carry out the attack. And that's what you're after in this business. You're trying to thwart as many plots as you possibly can. And the FBI has done a very good job here domestically at doing that. Their concept of disruption is one that they may have a highly classified intelligence case on a suspected terrorist operative in the country, but they're going to try to capture and nail that individual at the lowest common denominator, meaning visa fraud, passport fraud, immigration violations, and deport and move to disrupt that terror plot. And that's one of the reasons why we've been so successful. And my hat's off to the New York City Police Department Counterterrorism Division. They have been doing a wonderful job at prevention, and it's really the model that other cities around the nation really need to move to.
But I suspect there's still some pretty big gaps in our fight against terror. Do you have any recommendations on how to close the gaps?
One of the biggest gaps that I see is our southern border. We have insurgent kind of activity taking place in Mexico, which is close to being a failed nation in many ways. You have the Calderon administration under relentless pressure from the cartels. There's a tremendous corruption.
But that's drugs. Drugs connected to what you're talking about?
Narcoterrorism, meaning the ability for the terrorists to influence what's taking place and the ability for the narcos to transit in terrorist elements through our southern border. The cartels will move people into the United States for any reason as long as they're making money. They could care less if it's an illegal national or an Al-Qaeda operative. So that is our biggest challenge today from a homeland security perspective, in my opinion.
Is there ever a time when having access to a lot of information can have a negative effect? You say that perhaps ignorance is a good thing at times.
It depends. I think the American public, I'll speak for myself in that and from the folks I've talked to and know, the more information the American public knows, the better. So you can make an informed decision, whether that informed decision is I want to ride the subway today or I want to get on that airplane tomorrow. So I think the more the American public knows, the better off we all are.
But we have also heard recently about escalated terror threats that turned out to have a political side, rather. For example, before an election, suddenly we go to orange alert. I don't know what it feels like to people who are professionals in this field, whether they are disillusioned by that or just think, well, it's okay, that's the way things are done.
There's a tremendous amount of oversight when it comes to making threat assessments or moving color codes of Homeland Security alerts. And the pressure to produce factual types of threat assessments and analysis today is great, meaning that there's so many different eyes that look at these kinds of threat assessments today that I think the American public can rest assured that what they're getting from the government is a pretty quality product.
So you think the color-coded alert system is a good idea?
I don't personally like the color codes because I think that if you ask the average American what color code we are on today, nobody would know the answer to that question, and it's not going to affect how you do your daily job.
Well, we did hear at one point that the New York City subway system was under threat, and it turned out to be nothing. I wonder whether doing that sort of thing, alerting people, is just stirring them up, or whether, I rode the subways that day anyway because there was no other way for me to get to work.
I think that if you look at New York City will always be in the gun sights of the jihadists, specifically al-Qaeda. They always go back to where they're comfortable in operating in. The subway systems today in New York City are vulnerable. You can see as what happened in the London 7/7 attack, the Madrid 3/11 attack, the attempted bombing in London on 7/21. I think, again, the New York City Police Department, from a counterterrorism perspective, is doing a very good job on intelligence collection and monitoring the threat, though.
Why did you leave the Diplomatic Security Service?
It was time to go. I had spent my entire career in the counterterrorism arena. I work now for a private intelligence company called Stratfor, Strategic Forecasting, that's based in Austin, Texas. In many ways, I can do things now that I couldn't do in the government. We do a lot of work for the multinational corporations around the world, as well as for the public sector and state and local law enforcement. So in many ways, I'm still in the game. And I can go on programs like this and discuss the terror threat.
Well, did you have to have this book vetted?
I'm sorry?
Did you have to have the book vetted?
No, I did not.
Oh, because if you had been in the FBI or the CIA, you would have.
Right. I mean, I think if you look at this book, you'll see that I chronicle a lot of it is my personal reflection upon things that happened to me as a family. It's not all about terrorism. It has a lot to do with some of my good friends that I grew up with and where I came from and how I got from point A to point B. So the book itself does not really chronicle with a laser focus on counterterrorism, but it also brings in the personal aspects of how does someone go from being a police officer to a counterterrorism agent, and how does that affect you as a person and a father.
Does the DSS come to you for information these days?
I maintain a very good network of current and former DSS agents. The organization, I'm very proud of the organization. The organization is really on the front lines of terror around the globe, and I would hope that publicity surrounding the book also helps them in recruitment and retention, which is affects everybody in the federal sector today because it's very easy to get burned out. The DSS does a tremendous amount of protection, which I talk about in the book, from individuals in the past like Yasser Arafat to Princess Diana, and most average citizens see that kind of protective detail and think that it's the U.S. Secret Service. Well, in essence, it's the Diplomatic Security Service. And they're protecting dignitaries in the U.S. and in Baghdad and Beirut and all around the globe.
And are there terror threats that we just don't hear about that get squelched?
Every day. Every day the DSS and the national level intelligence community are dealing with serious terror threats.
A listener wants to know if the United States talked about retaliating for Buckley's death.
No, we did not. If decisions like that or discussions like that were made, I wasn't privileged to them. We knew Hezbollah had did it. We also knew that there was a strong possibility that the Iranian intelligence service had participated in debriefings of Buckley. You got to remember, when Buckley was grabbed, this is the senior CIA official in country. So we were desperately looking for him because of the potential compromise as well as from a human factor.
Now, I'm looking over your top 10 terrorist list. Hezbollah doesn't make it until number 5, was number 6. Why do you have Hassan Izz-al-Din, a.k.a. Ahmed Gabaya, and Samir Salwan, and Saeed? The man has a lot of different names. Why is he the top guy right now?
Hassan Izz-al-Din is Hezbollah. He still is a member of Hezbollah. He was basically the tactical ops guy for Imad Magnia, who the Israelis just assassinated in Damascus, Syria. Now, Hassan Izz-al-Din was involved with Buckley's kidnapping, a lot of the original hostages that were taken. He was also involved in the hijacking of TWA Flight 847 and the death of U.S. Navy diver Robert Stedham.
So we can assume that he's planning something right now if he's done so many things in the past.
Absolutely, as well as Mugnia was before. He was also involved with liaison with the Iranians and killing American troops in Iraq.
Fred Burton's book is Ghost Confessions of a Counterterrorism Agent. It is published by Random House. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.